Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Elaine Lowe, who is a staff writer at The Ankler and the author of the Strikegeist newsletter, amongst other duties at The Ankler. I really enjoyed reading Strikegeist during the recent WGA strikes because it was on the ground, on the front lines, reporting from the picket lines and everything else. It was a slightly more tempered version of what we were hearing on Twitter, which, would tend to get a little heated and crazy sometimes. But it was great to have that firsthand point of view. Elaine, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks for being a Strikegeist reader. It's been a long 149 days now.
Well, it's not over yet. We still got SAG after strike, but we're getting there. All right. So the WGA deal is done-ish. It still has to be ratified by the members and everything. But, it looks like we've got a pretty good deal. People seem happy about it. Mm-hmm. And there's the standard percent raises and all that sort of stuff. But there were three big, pretty interesting and new things that got hammered out during this conversation that I think are worth diving into and worth explaining to folks who didn't, who either didn't know what was at stake or kind of confused by some of the issues that have come down. And let's take a look at them. So the first is writers' rooms. Writers' rooms were a big point of contention in this strike. The writers wanted more guaranteed spots for writers on TV shows. The studio said, no, this is ridiculous. You don't need that. What was the deal that was made, and what were they fighting over, really? Because I think that's a key thing for folks to understand when they're looking at the resolution here is what were the writers actually really after?
I mean, it all comes down to the sustainability of the profession, right? Like, time and again, when I was out on the picket lines, and even well before the strike, the thing that I would hear from writers is it's hard for writing, for TV writing or film writing, to be a sustainable profession anymore. I mean, and you sort of add on top of that the cost of living in a city like LA or New York, that has additional challenges. But the main disruptor has been the streaming economy, because before, a broadcast sitcom would go 22, 24 episodes on CBS or NBC or ABC, and you could make a whole meal out of that. That was part of your career. That was a year-long job. Nowadays, there are so many streaming shows. I mean, we live in the era of peak TV, where there are literally, 600 new scripted shows this past year. But how many of those are small streaming shows that are like 6, 8, 10 episodes? And so I'd hear from folks that say, I would do a 6-episode series, and then it would be months and months between work. And these rooms, too, these writers' rooms would get smaller and smaller. Instead of having, 10, 15 writers in a room, there's something that the writers hate called mini rooms, which is, the studios would try and get 2 or 3 writers a room to break open a whole season. And essentially, it's the same labor issue that impacts so many other industries, right? It's that companies try to get more out of folks for less. And I think that's something that, no matter what industry you're in, I think it's just sort of a recurring pressure. And that's a thing that writers felt all across town, all across the country. And so the staffing minimums was really a way to try and codify, that part of the profession. To make sure that writing is still a full-time job in their view.
And there are actual codified numbers here. What were the gains that the writers got?
Yeah, so the writers were initially looking for a minimum staff of about 6 writers. And what they initially were told, according to the guild, is that the AMPTP, which is the negotiating unit which represents studios from Disney to Netflix, rejected those proposals, didn't make a counter. Ultimately, between May and September, what the agreement ultimately was that there would be a minimum of three writers. And let me make sure I have this right. It's at least three writers on a series of six episodes or fewer, five writers on shows that are 7 to 12 episodes, and at least six writers on shows that are at least 13 episodes long. So, you know, they went a long way to getting some kind of codification of that.
And there was, during the strike, there was some chatter among showrunners, some of whom write whole seasons by themselves, right? So guys like Taylor Sheridan said, well, I don't need six writers on Yellowstone. I do it all myself. Or White Lotus, right, is another show that is run by a guy. He writes it all, and that's it. And they said, well, we don't need writers' rooms. We don't want writers' rooms. You know, why are we fighting about this? Why are we fighting for this? And the counter to that, which I think is true and smart, is that, you know, the first-time showrunners are not going to have the leverage to say, well, I would like to have six writers on my show. You know, they're going to be pressured to go the Sheridan route, right? That was like the kind of breakdown, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had Adam Conover, who, you know, he ran the show Adam Ruins Everything, and is also a WGA negotiating committee member on our own podcast yesterday, and he broke it down for us. He, you know, told us, like, hey, like, as a showrunner, as a first-time showrunner, I didn't have that power. I wasn't given a budget. I was just told, here, you can hire X number of writers. And that's frequently, and I think there's sort of a little bit of discrepancy too, like when I think folks outside of the industry are looking in, because when you think of like a showrunner, maybe you're thinking of like a Ryan Murphy or a Shonda Rhimes, people who have, you know, had really prolific careers, who have reached a point in their career where there's a great deal of creative control. But a lot of folks are first time showrunners and, you know, feel that they have to be able to accommodate their bosses, which, I mean, I think, again, is true of any kind of industry when you're, you know, even sort of slowly coming into a position where there's more decision making power. And so, you know, that's why this sort of codification exists. But I think there is also built in, Adam was telling us yesterday, an exemption for, I think it's if there is a contract that says this person is going to write all eight episodes, then they'll be able to do that. So there is still an exemption for the Taylor Sheridans, for the folks who want to be the sole creator.
Yeah. And there, and I think some of those shows are getting grandfathered in too, right?
Like, yeah, it's,
you know, if they're if they were already one man shows, and so be it. All right. The next big issue here that is pretty interesting is the performance-based residuals on the streaming originals. I was getting questions from friends who were asking me to break it down for them, and frankly, I didn't know the answer to a few of them. So I'm hoping you might be able to help me out here and make
it look smart
to everybody else. Okay. All right. So for instance, just to set the stage for everybody, there's a threshold. If a show is watched by, I think it's 20% or more of the subscribers over the first 3 months of release, or I guess over any subsequent 3 months, that there will be a bonus for, let me see, what are the numbers here?
It's up to 50% of the fixed domestic and foreign residuals. So, okay. You know, the bonus for, let's see, in the 2023 year would be like about over $9,000 for a half hour episode, about $16,000 for a 1 hour episode, and then over $40,000 for a streaming feature that's over $30 million in budget. And this is really, you know, my understanding is the viewership based streaming residual is something to counter the fact that streaming residuals compared to residuals for a broadcast TV show, again, it's like it's the difference between that big 22, 24 episode CBS sitcom versus the, you know, like six episode Netflix limited series or something, where writers would tell me, you know, I've had so many writers tell me, I used to be able to live off of residuals and now it's impossible. And I'm doing the same amount of work. It's just that the residuals are lower. So the viewership based residual is designed to sort of offer a success based bonus, you know, like, because again, I think we've also read media reports of huge streaming hits where maybe we don't realize, you know, just how much of a difference in compensation there is from the expectation for writers and cast.
Well, let me ask. All right. So specifically, the question I had was, all right, so writers will receive a bonus, you know, between 9,000 and 16,000 or something like that for TV episodes. Is it the credited writer on an episode of TV? Like every credit they get, they will get a bonus like that. Because I,
or
I
is it like the whole
like,
room? You mean
right? Is it like does the whole room get the $9,000 bonus and then it's split three ways or five ways or whatever per episode? I mean, I guess that would be my question here is exactly how that payout happens, if it goes to the credited writer or and also like again specifically we're talking there the way it's broken down in the contract is by episodes, but. My understanding is that the streamers just kind of get the numbers for the whole season. It's like we have here's this first season of, you know, Wednesday or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Squid Games. Like, I don't think they're broken down necessarily by episode.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe this is something we still need to figure out.
I was going to say, I think this is something I can't tell you. I'm not going to pretend to know. All I have is the language in the contract and what Adam was telling us yesterday. So I don't think we know all the details of that yet. But okay. You also alluded to something else, which was the data transparency part of it, right? Which
yes.
The writers, you know, got some of what they were asking for. I think it was that there's the streamers will release, I think, sort of the total number of hours watched, which, you know, still doesn't provide you the kind of data that I think they have internally where they're able, obviously, to like they have a fire hose of data. They're able to slice and dice it any which way they want. But it's something. It's a step in that direction. And again, talking to Adam yesterday, he saw it as a positive development because I think the idea is to then build on that progress in subsequent contracts. Because when I talk to showrunners, one of their issues when writing for streaming shows is sometimes, depending on which streamer, and every streamer is different, every streamer counts a view differently, and every streamer releases different segments of information to their showrunners. So it's like some of them may get engagement metrics, some of them may feel like they get nothing at all. Some of them have told me, oh, they wouldn't give me exact viewership data, but they showed me how my show performed in comparison to a different popular show on the service. So, you know, this is sort of a step toward figuring out in lieu of sort of the old fashioned, like broadcast Nielsen data, you know, how things are doing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I am curious to see how much of that data actually comes out and what we see. And I believe there was some agreement between the union and the AMPTP that the data would be kept confidential-ish. Right. I mean, that was one of the initial things.
And that one, like I said, I'd have to go and refer to the contract too. I honestly, like, I think we're all still sort of digesting the contract terms here. And I'm expecting that things will slowly be spelled out for us as they're actually implemented.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy. Have you heard from any of the folks on the actor side how they feel about this? Because this is a big ask for them as well. They're looking for. You know, something like I think it was 2% of revenue from streamers for a success-based residual.
That's like sort of a different ask. But, you know, I'll be very interested to see how much of a precedent and how much of, I guess, an advantage this gives SAG-AFTRA as they're going into their negotiations, which restart on Monday on the 2nd. Monday is the 2nd, right? It starts in early October.
It's coming up here.
No, it's been a long 4.5 months. but it's like, you know, with AI protections, right? It's like they are also looking for AI protections, and they're also looking for some kind of like sort of similar success-based revenue share / residual, basically a participation in that profit, right? But the language is going to be something different because, you know, writers are dealing with, say, AI in terms of the written word, and then SAG-AFTRA is dealing with AI in terms of, like, performance capture and, you know, scanning background actors. So it's, like, same concept, but the implementation and the execution of that, I think, is going to be really different. I think it sets something of, like, a broad philosophical template, if nothing else.
Well, let's talk about AI, because AI is the third of the big new things. I mean, what agreement did the studios and the writers come to on how AI can be used, you know, as a tool versus as a replacement? Because I know that's what the writers were worried about.
Yeah,
I mean, I want to say, first off, I personally, and maybe this was just naive of me, was really surprised at how much of an issue AI became on the picket lines, given that going in, it's not something that I traditionally heard writers have an issue with. But I think it really came to the fore. And I mean, it's such a fast-moving technology. Like, I'll tell you, I've seen and heard, like, AI software, and this is more on the performer side, but it can, like, replicate Morgan Freeman's voice. So it makes Morgan Freeman sound like he's speaking in fluent Spanish as opposed to like having another actor dub over. So it's like the technology is there in many different ways. But I was really surprised to see how many people had like AI related picket signs. But I guess that's also a factor of just it's sort of being like an easily digestible concept outside of Hollywood as well. But essentially what the writers agreed upon was that AI can't write or rewrite for them. It can't produce source material, and studios can't force writers essentially to use AI software like ChatGPT or something. Although if both the studio and the writer decide together to use, AI software, they can do that. And then there's also a last bit on training data, which, again, talking to Adam Conover yesterday, he said it's basically the site of a future battle. Because the guild, you know, quote unquote, reserves the right to assert that exploitation of writers' material to train AI is prohibited by this minimum basic agreement or other law, which, I mean, is sort of like I was trying to unpack that language a little bit yesterday. And I think basically it's just sort of like setting the tone for, you know, we have the right to challenge this if we feel like there's exploitative training, was my sense.
Yeah, listening to him yesterday on your podcast, what it sounded like to me was, if you do this wrong, we're going to sue you.
Yeah.
That kind of language, which is always, you know, that is not necessarily ideal if you're in a labor situation. You don't want to be like, we're going to have to, you know, get the courts on you. But it's a fascinating topic for the reason you mentioned. I mean, you know, the actors are worried about people putting their faces on weird things in movies, and you know, I think for good reason. And the writers, you know, it's interesting talking to the writers because half of them are like, the AI is never going to be good enough to do what we do, and the other half are like, Terminator is here, and we have to send John Connor back to kill ChatGPT now. Like, it's, you know, it's wild.
Yeah. I think the truth is basically, as with all emerging technology, like ultimately we'll have to find a way to live with it, right? It's like AI isn't going anywhere. AI is already used in so many different parts of the business. I mean, gosh, it's like even outside of Hollywood, it's like I see AI creeping up. And I've said this before, and this is so boring, but like, you know, back when I used to be a stock market reporter writing earnings reports, at some point there was automated writing technology. There was an AI that was introduced that could just pluck, like, oh, did they beat on earnings? Did they miss on earnings? And being a very young 20-something reporter at the time, I was like, oh no, that's my whole job. Like, this thing could be, this thing's going to replace me. But also, you know, it didn't, because there's still the human element where it's like, you can add context to things. You can react in ways that the AI can't. Like, it's what it's doing is it's feasting on the available information, but there are many, many human elements, which I think there's a long way to go before it can replicate those. I mean, of course, I say this now and watch tomorrow AI's writing my Strike Guys newsletter.
the AI podcast is going to be great. It's funny you mentioned the digesting the news, because, like, you know, one of the things that we're seeing with the language models is when they start scraping the web for everything, these models all get much dumber because there's so much bad information out there. I mean, there's just endless reams of bad information, which in turn, like, makes me think of the writers a little bit, because there are a lot of bad scripts out there as well. And if you just throw...
So you throw the kitchen sink at it, yeah.
You throw a million scripts in there, 999,000 of them are bad already. So, like, is that the sort of thing that you're going to want to come out? I don't know. It's interesting. All right, so let's just quickly. What else came out of the strike? What else did the writers get? What else did the studios get? What are we looking at here for the rest of the?
Well, you know, the guild touted this as a quote unquote exceptional deal, which I think, like, set the bar really high. because it was such a protracted battle. But you know, the thing that they said was we really got wins for every segment of the membership. And I mean, it seems like they got a great deal of what they were asking for. There were things for, you know, screenwriters, for film writers, basically second step payments, improved payment schedules. And then for writing teams, like, you know, TV writers who work in pairs, you know, are able to get pension and health contributions that sort of represent like that match each writer as a whole person rather than making them like split a fee, which is huge in terms of, you know, qualifying for health insurance and everything. So there were some significant things which are not, I think, like big, bold headlines to folks who work outside of the industry, but to folks here are really significant increases. You know, obviously they didn't get everything they were asking for, but that's the nature of any negotiation. My sense is, though, that the wins that the Writers Guild got were far more than I think folks were initially thinking they would achieve back in May. There was a lot of skepticism about whether the strike would work, about whether having a strike that ran this long would be effective. And I think the result speaks for itself.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, let's bring this to the other thing I really wanted to talk to you about was how this strike felt different from the last strike back in 07-08. This felt like a much different. The vibe was different. The vibe was different. And I'm curious how the mood on both the picket lines and on social media kind of influenced that, because I really do think that we saw a real sea change here in how the writers behaved and reacted and supported each other, in part because of just the kind of omnipresent, ever awake, ever aware nature of Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, TikTok and whatever else. But like really Twitter, that's where writers hang out.
Twitter, many of us thought we would abandon in the spring, and then suddenly became the place to be.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, there was no similar thing in 07-08, by all accounts. When I talk to folks, they tell me, when I've spoken to people who are veterans of, you know, 2-3 different strikes, they're saying, okay, last time around, all the information we were getting were from the trades. We had to sort of just accept whatever information was coming to us. And we had to, you know, fact check things by word of mouth or share information by word of mouth. And now there's a much more immediate way to do that. And of course, like, let's also accept that there's some bad information that goes around on any social media platform. It's not all accurate, but it definitely allowed them to talk to each other in a way that I don't think they had the last time around. And also just sort of build on that voice. I mean, when you're talking about solidarity, and when you're talking about social media, I think there's the question, right, of like, yeah, but like how reflective of real life is Twitter, which is a valid question because it's a self-selected group, right? But there were so many writers who were just, I think, building on each other's voices there that it really did genuinely contribute to that sense of solidarity and also contributed to their ability to organize. Like when you're talking about them, the writers turned labor organizers these last few months. That became a real tool, too, in terms of saying, like, this is the themed picket we're doing down at Netflix today. And like, this is who we would love to see turn out for it. It became a very effective organizing tool, which I think was a very effective, like, real world implementation of social media. And then when you're talking about solidarity, so sort of a thing that I think people were grappling with at the beginning was like, how seriously do we take a bunch of writers and then actors who are on strike, right? Like, are they serious people? And ultimately, you know, I think they really showed that they were serious about organizing. They got a lot of support from IATSE, which represents, you know, like 150,000 craftspeople and crew members, and from the Teamsters, who really showed up and showed out.
And again, talking to veterans of the last strike, my impression, I didn't cover the last strike, but my impression was that they felt sometimes more alone. The writers felt a little bit more alone in 07, 08, and didn't necessarily feel that cross union as you know, as deep of an extent of that cross union solidarity that they feel now. So that really bolstered them. And then, of course, when the SAG-AFTRA strike started, having 160,000 performers also on the picket lines is really going to help you fortify your cause.
Yeah. The one place where I feel like you saw solidarity kick in most effectively really came toward the end when Drew Barrymore said she's bringing her show back, and Bill Maher is like, and the talk is coming back. And I look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misreading things again because I spend most of my time on Twitter instead of, you know, on the lines. But the sense I got was that the ability to pressure those shows into pulling out and shutting back down again and saying we're going to come back afterwards felt like the push that was needed, that the studios needed to really be like, OK, this is serious. We got to end this. I mean, like it felt very conspicuous, and maybe this was going to happen anyway, but it felt very conspicuous to have, like, a week later, you know, the CEOs in the room with the WGA.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair. And I hadn't really thought about it that way. But yeah, I think that's fair because, speaking of productions that were shut down throughout the summer, any kind of production, even before the SAG-AFTRA strike started, you had writers picketing, you know, in New York and in L.A. and shutting down most every production that they could, to the point where I would get these weekly updates from Film LA, which is the LA County's official film office. And, you know, that number kept dwindling down until it was like, there are no scripted TV series that have permits to film this week. And it was just that flat line for many, many months. And that didn't include, you know, like reality and like indie shows and things like that. But yeah, like anything union had been shut down. And so, again, this comes back to the writers being very effective at organizing and being very effective at sort of, you know, deciding on a target and saying, OK, this is the production we're going to picket, and this is the one that we're going to, you know, shut down today. And, you know, the Teamsters respected and didn't cross picket lines, IATSE. And so when it came to the talk shows, we were already in fall, like in the beginning of September, where the pressure was on. Right. And I've talked about this before, and you know, sorry to sound like a broken record if anyone's heard me say this before, but like Labor Day weekend was really an inflection point, I think, because there was the idea that, it's a summer strike, like it'll be over, we'll have figured everything out by September. And then Labor Day rolled around and that didn't happen. And I think people got a little nervous and anxiety levels really started rising. And then you started hearing things from the studio side of, you know, well, if writers' rooms don't go back in by like October, you know, we can't go back into production until at least January, because everybody knows November and December are dead zones in Hollywood, and there's just not a lot of production or anything else going on then. And so I think people were really looking out at the calendar and saying, okay, we really only have like, what, like 6 to 8 weeks or something after Labor Day to figure everything out and to try and like get the Hollywood machine back in gear. So yeah, there was like a heightened sense of anxiety too. And, you know, that's not to say that the writers weren't feeling the pressure. Like I've heard from so many writers and actors and crew people who have suffered an immense financial hardship over these last few months. And many of them support the strike. Many of them also note just how difficult it's been, to the point where some of them we're talking about leaving LA. You know, we're talking about trying to scrape, you know, side hustles together, trying to figure out what work they could do in the interim, because they just didn't know when the town was going to be back in business. But yeah, I mean, I think shutting down the talk shows, or at least, you know, applying enough pressure on the talk show hosts to walk back, restarting production, you know, was a sign that they still continued to be very serious, and not just about, you know, scripted TV, but about these talk shows, which, you know, each of them had, you know, a handful, maybe like 1 to 3 WGA writers, because these were all, you know, mostly WGA signatory shows, which meant that the hosts as SAG-AFTRA members were able to, you know, sort of within their right, go back into production, but the writers were on strike.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting. So, all right, we still have one strike goes on. As we mentioned, SAG, AFTRA, and AMPTP getting back in the room on Monday, October 2nd. What's the vibe like in terms of where that strike is. Do folks think that that will get wrapped up pretty quickly here and you'll get production back in the swing of things in November, December, or are the two sides still too far apart?
I think that's the hope, right? That they'll be able to resolve this quickly enough. I mean, I the two sides haven't spoken in months, so it's hard to say where they'll be once they get back into the room. But I think it would be safe to say that SAG-AFTRA is likely feeling, you know, a little more confidence going in, given the gains that the writers managed to achieve. And, you know, the writers have largely been in a hugely celebratory mood. You know, I went and visited a couple of the bars where these impromptu, spontaneous celebrations were happening Sunday night after it was announced that there was a deal. Like, we hadn't even seen what the deal was, but it was like, there's a deal. And like, people immediately just like flooded this one bar in North Hollywood. And I stopped by and, you know, there's just a sea of writers with drinks in hand. Occasionally you just hear random cheers go up in different parts of the crowd. Like, they were just happy that there was a deal, and they trusted that when the guild said it was exceptional, they were basically like, yeah, we trust that it is, even though it would be another 2 days before they actually saw the deal language. So, I mean, I think that probably gives SAG a lot of, you know, confidence.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was everything I wanted to ask. What do you think folks should know about either the deal or the strike or anything else going on in the business of Hollywood right now? I always like to close these interviews by asking what I should have asked. So what should I have asked? What do people need to know?
Oh, I think I've blathered on long enough. But I mean, there's still 160,000 people out on strike, right? I mean, I think, I don't know, there's this huge exhale of relief that the Writers Guild strike is over, and that there's a deal that, you know, the writers seem happy with, and are, you know, they were technically back to work yesterday. The strike ended at midnight on Tuesday night. But yeah, there's still 160,000 people on strike, and I think the conventional wisdom is that it should hopefully wrap up soon, but you never know.
Yeah. All right, so Strikegeist continues. Go sign up. It's free. It's at the Ankler. And you should sign up for everything at the Ankler, too. You should be a paying subscriber, as I am.
Yay.
But but if you aren't and you just want a taste, Strikegeist is still free, right? It is. Yeah, it's, mm-hmm. it's yep.
It
it's,
is still free. So. And excellent. While SAG-AFTRA is negotiating their TV theatrical contract, they've also authorized a video game strike. So who's to say if Strikegeist will have more to write about after?
It's the rolling strikes of 2023.
We're in a real labor movement here.
All right. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. Thanks again for joining us, Elaine from The Ankler. Really, really great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.